After my father died 2 years ago, we began, as families do, to arrange his things, his desk and his tools, his books, his guns, his clothes. In every life, there is order, there is play, there is hope, there is justice, there is humor. We didn't make much progress. We still haven't made that much. The desk has little folders with titles there. It's a step. The tools that are four generations deep, including the ones purchased in the last, are there a little bit more tidily arranged. The books, now there's a story. 40 years a preacher under Allen, A-L-L-A-N, Knight Chalmers, for whom I was named, who taught his students to read a book a day. There are plenty, plenty of books. The gun's a relic of North Country deer hunting, handled by, legally I might add, by two lawyer siblings. And the clothes for work and for play, there in the closet, a dollhouse built for a granddaughter that was brought back for repair, but never was repaired and now has been fixed and sent to a great-granddaughter's home. We didn't make very much progress, and I was either asked or assigned or self-assigned to deal with the books, and I dawdled and lollygagged and procrastinated. I found a ways to avoid, and then when I went, I found I didn't make much headway at all. I took some collections of sermons, Tittle and Fosdick, Chalmers himself, some Boston books, Booth and Bowne and Thurman, a collection of Jacques Ellul, which we used in a Lenten series 2 years ago. But you know, each time I went, I found that I went more slowly because I was reading not just the signature and the dating, but those little markings in the margin, the notations, and especially the underlining. And I was wondering, first, what is that? And then second, what does that mean? The lasting grief of the earthly loss of my dad, strangely, has found a spiritual bridge across the River Styx, earth to heaven, in a humble preacher's library. We're in communion, he and I, through the underlining. This is Parents Weekend, and while the separation of leaving and letting go and coming and going is not as mammoth, that is, the distance from Minneapolis to Boston is not quite the distance from earth to heaven, but it's mammoth enough. Those who leave and those who are left behind, those who are giving up and those who are going on. These are difficult sacrifices. I haven't even begun to discuss the tuition check beginning and end of semester. Maybe that's why we come, parents and children, to worship on Sunday, because we recognize that there will be times in the future when a spiritual bridge is needed across a great chasm, an expanding chasm. Hear the good news from Mark chapter 10, 35, recommended to us today as your spiritual bridge generation to generation is the excitement and verve of real religious experience. By that I mean more experience than religion, but religious experience nonetheless. Not so much chancel and pulpit and organ and stained glass and a clerical collar and preaching gown, but ordinary, daily, head of the Charles, Sunday afternoon, resplendent, religious experience. After a while this summer, I went back and I found in the books a tome whose title I recognized. It was written in 1969. It was written, as it happens, by a colleague, an acquaintance, a friend here at Boston University still. Its title was stolen for today's sermon title, A Rumor of Angels by Dr. Peter Berger. I knew of the book, and I knew its argument that God is not dead, that religion is not dead, that religious experience is not very far away, but Confession being good for the soul, I had never read it. I stuffed it in my bag. It's hard to recast for you the context of 1968, and I shan't try except to sketch what it was like when he was writing. 1968, when the strongest term in the religious vocabulary was the word secular, when the cover of Time magazine carried the title, Is God Dead? When a few years earlier, some administrative malfeasance led to experiments in the basement of Marsh Chapel, when the greatest camp meeting of the age, the greatest religious gathering and musical camp meeting of the age happened in a small town in upstate New York called Woodstock, in the mud and in the rain. What were those young people thinking? When all hell was breaking loose, Peter Berger wrote about heaven. He wrote about signs of transcendence. He wrote about experience, incandescent. He wrote about signposts to transcendence. You may not think of yourself as a very religious person, and that's fine. But under the little things, the wee little blankets, day to day, evening and morning, if you listen, you may just see and sense something of the eternal. Berger's outline is as contemporary today as it was 43 years ago. 2 weeks from now, I'll have lunch with him and see how I did. You know, it's a little bit like that Woody Allen film where Woody Allen is waiting for a ticket at a movie theater. He's trying to impress his girlfriend, so he talks about Marshall McLuhan, Marshall McLuhan's books, Marshall McLuhan's philosophy, Marshall McLuhan's cultural critique. And all of a sudden, the man ahead of him in line turns around, and it's Marshall McLuhan. And he turns to Allen's character and says, you know, everything you've said and I've heard is totally bogus, so I hope that won't happen at lunch. I don't think it will. That is, under the aegis of Mark 10 and 35, which reminds us that things aren't always quite as they seem, that appearance and reality are not equivalent, that the littlest becomes the largest, the least becomes the most, twists us a little bit, reminds us of the power of experience. We'll call it religious, by that I mean non-religious experience. First, in your life now, in a blessed rage for order, as David Tracy called it a generation later. Almost every one of us in this sanctuary and listening across the radio waves, North Shore, Cape Cod, all, has in some way a sense and a desire for order. Some of us are neat freaks. When in doubt, throw it out. Some of us are hoarders. Never throw anything away. Both are signs of a desire for order. Berger wrote that there is in the human being a sense of orderliness, a desire, a trust in reality that over time, ultimately, we might say, there is to be an order to things. Things will be set right. There is a place and time in order. Parents, young adult children, over time, talk a bit about these things. They may be your spiritual bridge. You blessed ones who have voice and sight and face to face. Second, there is the matter of play. Especially when adults play, they leave one time zone, if you will, and enter another. There's something Berger wrote about the deathless innocence of childhood that returns to adults who deign to enter the time of play. I see every summer middle-aged men going 3 or 4 hours across a green field, following a tiny little white ball that seems to have a mind of its own. I see women and men up and down Newberry Street, hunting, looking, purchasing, laughing. They seem to be enjoying themselves. I hear students talk about something called the World of Warcraft, some game that's out there and lastingly endless. I hear a student right here on Commonwealth Avenue, "Where have you been?" "I've been playing intramural basketball." "How was it?" "It was awesome." When we enter that time zone called play, especially as adults, we move into another kind of experience, a deathless innocence. Those of you who saw the film Moonrise Kingdom recently know exactly the point of the gospel there. Talk about it a bit, parents and children. There is as well a sign, an incandescent sign of lasting meaning in hope. Hope springs eternal in the human breast. Man never lives but always to be blessed. That's Pope, but it's close to us. Yesterday in the library, I see the Martin King quote, "You take one step, but you don't know where the staircase is going." Where there's life, there's hope. Better said, where there's hope, there's life. We saw a real film called Hope Springs with Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones about a marriage that's challenged and a couple that was willing, honestly, to struggle and make things not perfect, but a little bit better, wrote Berger so long ago. The human being is inherently hopeful. Hopeful, consequently oriented toward the future. Hopeful, consequently involved in projects. Our projects are so important to us, from the child in the nursery with games and balls and toys, to the elderly man in the nursing home writing painstakingly a memoir. We are beings who lean toward the future. Parents, children, talk about it. There's a spiritual bridge there across which we may find happy communion. Berger's fourth, I shift a little bit. He used the word damnation, and I don't have time to explain what he meant by that, so I'm going to use the word justice. Every one of us has a lasting sense that when someone gets away with murder, they shouldn't get away with murder. And that there are some things in this life that are so tragic and so awful, as Berger wrote, they cry out to heaven. And as he then wrote, those things that cry out to heaven cry out for hell. And by that he meant a sense somehow, a desire somehow, a longing somehow for retributive justice. Those of us who listen, as we do this month, three times to Elie Wiesel, have an inkling, a glimpse, a hint of what Berger meant, what we know in our experience, that there is a desire that somehow, in a way we can't see, things be set right. Talk about it, bit by bit, parents and children. Maybe the polar opposite of this longing for justice is the laughter that comes with humor. The psalmist says, "He who sits in the heavens shall laugh." And humor is part of what feeds us and reminds us that the human spirit sometimes feels a little cramped in the earthly condition. There's something eternal, lasting, an existential discrepancy in the human being that comes out in wit. I was asked a couple of weeks ago to pray over the beginning of a $1 billion capital campaign for the university, never having done such, and I began by saying, they asked if I would do it, and I said I would. I said it would be my pressure. I mean my pleasure. People will ask about interfaith life, who are the most Christian groups on campus, and they think it's InterVarsity or the Servant Team or the choir. But when I think about love and joy and peace, patience, kindness, and goodness, I tell them, let me tell you, the most Christian people I deal with week by week are the Hindus, and you'll find them downstairs on Saturday morning. There's a sense that humor gives of building and opening. The older among you will remember Phyllis Diller, called to glory, gone to glory this summer. Maybe you remember her self-deprecating wit. The name she gave her husband, Fang. The name she gave her corpulent mother-in-law, Moby Dick. The name she gave her feisty sister-in-law, Captain Bligh. But through it all, that unique, high-pitched laughter. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. It reminds us, this humor does, that there's something eternal in every human being. We who are blessed to have parents and children with whom to speak want over the next Thanksgiving, Christmas, spring break, Easter, and summertime to build a spiritual bridge, to speak heart to heart to one another about order and play and hope and justice and humor. That's what this gospel is telling us. Things aren't quite as they seem. Appearance and reality are not equivalent. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. The one who is last shall be first. The smallest becomes the greatest. And his life is given as a ransom. This is the way Mark explains the cross itself. Meaning today, at least, we shall note that God's life is given up, laid out, laid down, the divine life gone, so that human life might thrive. Oh, you say, Dean Hill, I'm not all that religious. But maybe, just maybe, there is that experience for you even today, underneath a craving for order, underneath an enjoyment of play, underneath a desire for hope, underneath a longing for justice, underneath the laughter of humor. Right now, a moment, a presence, a mystery, a breath. A rumor of angels.